I'm Cynthia Gold, and I'm from the University of Pittsburgh, and it is my pleasure this morning to introduce Casey Green and welcome you to this session on Campus Computing 2011, the National Survey of E-Learning and Information Technology in American Higher Education. Casey and I were just talking that we think that, you know, next year, when he reports on the survey for 2011 or 2012, we'll start the morning out with Bruce Springsteen or something like that to, you know, wake everybody up a little bit. But before I introduce Casey, it's my job to ask you to remember to fill out the online evaluations. The folks at EDUCAUSE and all the speakers really appreciate your input, and they do pay attention to it and use it. So at the end of the session, please don't forget, it's online, and you can find it on the EDUCAUSE website. So now, to introduce Casey. For many of you who have been coming to this session each year, or if you have been reading the annual Campus Computing Survey results, I don't think Casey needs an introduction for you. But if you're new to the profession or you're new to IT and higher education, you have only to follow the comments on the CIO list to find out how valuable these survey results are to our community and how they inform our decision-making and campus planning, and not just for IT, but for libraries and campus services and curricula and much more. As the largest continuing study of the role of information technology in American colleges and universities, the project is widely cited by both campus officials and corporate executives as the definitive source for information about IT issues affecting American higher education. Casey has written numerous books and articles, and his work has been cited by the New York Times and the LA Times and CNN and lots of other print and broadcast media. But you also might want to know that he has a long history with EDUCAUSE and with our predecessor associations, EDUCOM and CAUSE. In October of 2002, Casey was the initial recipient of the EDUCAUSE Award for Leadership in Public Policy and Practice. When I went back and looked at the 1990 Campus Computing Survey, which was the first one, the closing paragraph said that the 1990 survey is the first of what EDUCOM hopes will be a continuing series of research projects that explores the way campuses are utilizing desktop computing as a resource for instruction and research. I think it's safe to say that the exploration has continued, moving well beyond desktop computing, so we look forward to hearing from Casey today about what all of you had to say in the 2011 survey and what it might mean for us in the year ahead. Casey.
Good morning. Nicely done. This is our annual gathering of the Campus Computing Tribe. My thanks to all of you who completed our survey, whether you got it in on time the first time or you got it in on time the second, third, or fourth time. I'll explain that in a few moments. This is the 22nd survey. Cynthia, I had forgotten those closing words from the first report. I guess we have proven ourselves session-worthy over the years. Some of you have gone gray, and if you have a Y chromosome, others have gone gray or thinning hair coming to these sessions over the past two decades. Let me begin by saying all the slides are already posted on the Campus Computing website for those of you who are desperate to get this stuff. It's up there. It's campuscomputing.net. You can find it on the homepage as a thing that says what's new at Campus Computing, and it's there. So I'm going to roll through this presentation quite quickly, as I often do. We'll take questions at the end, and let's get started. Briefly, I want to acknowledge our 36 corporate sponsors who really pay a very modest subscription fee to help underwrite this work. They make possible the opportunity for me to bring data to this community, and I am very appreciative of their continuing support. Some of these sponsors have been with us from the beginning when we launched the survey in 1990. For those of you who are still in graduate degrees or not far removed from them, very quickly about the methodology, we had 496 respondents, down a little bit from last year. We like to be in the 530 to 550 range. You'll see some additional data about that in a moment. It is a web-based survey collection. We target individuals. It's not a cattle call, so there is not an open questionnaire for campus computing. With due respect to many of you who are not directors or deputy directors or associate CIOs or CTOs, we are trying to get data from the office of the CIO. We know that in many instances that can be a committee process that then goes through that office before it's posted. And the survey data are fresh. We froze these data a week ago today. And even after that, we had another dozen questionnaires that trickled in, including some on Monday. 80% of the survey participants in 2011 participated in the 2010 survey, and that number has been fairly consistent over the years, which means that we have great faith in the sort of the validity and reliability of these data from campuses who have continued to participate in the survey and the continuity of the data stream over time. In terms of looking at data by segment, just very quickly, the way to read this table is, for example, public research universities. If you look at the data from IPEDS, the Integrated Postsecondary Education Data System, in terms of a classification of institutions, there are 168, right, bigger type there, public and private research universities in the United States. We had 76 that participated in the survey, approximately half of the sample. So the numbers range by segment, but we feel we've got pretty good coverage across all segments with some exceptions. First, we do not survey two-year private colleges. There are about 250 of those. They're typically small in number. Second, we eliminate from the sample some 1,100 campuses that are enroll under 500 students. Those campuses represent roughly 27% of colleges and universities in the United States, but only represent 2% of the headcount. Third, private nonprofits have historically not participated in the survey because of a corporate culture that says we don't share any information about the secret sauce. And then we work into a stratified random sample. So we begin with about 1,400 campuses. We get about 150 non-deliverables because many of you are shifting jobs over time. Wind up with a sample of an outbound sample of about 1,250, of which 496 of you got your surveys in on time. And speaking to the matter of time, I guess my survey is sort of like a midterm for many of you. We announced the survey deadline of October 7th, and had we frozen the survey, then we would not have had almost half the sample. This is what keeps me up at night. I've gotten used to a flood of surveys in the last couple of days, not quite, though, and this year was the most challenging in terms of having 50% come in after the official deadline, and then another dozen come in after we had to freeze the survey. I am very appreciative of your efforts. And I know sometimes it's a group effort and sometimes it's a late night effort to get this thing done. We try to make it easy by pre-populating the survey with last year's data for this year's data. But folks, let me sleep at night next year. Try to get it in a day or two early, or don't call me at 10 o'clock in the evening after we've frozen and saying, can we still be included in the survey, as happened in one or two instances. Quick highlights from 2011. Some of you may have already seen this in the Chronicle and Inside Higher Ed today. We saw big gains in the deployment of mobile apps. Huge jumps from last year to this. And that's not surprising. You know, we see mobility every place else we go. Why not on college campuses? Why is it, for example, that I could get off a plane in Philadelphia, in 45 seconds download a mobile app to help me navigate the city, and at least a year ago, I couldn't do that at many college campuses. This is another example of where the consumer experience and consumer entitlements, expectations, lead what's going on many campuses. The budget cuts are not as bad as they had been. We had a significant, interesting and dramatic drop in the percentage of campuses that reported budget cuts, but it is still painfully high. And for those of you who have to manage these things, again, this is an unusual cycle because normally it's almost biblical. We don't quite get 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine, but at least it's only once a decade that we get a downturn. Painfully, you know, we had a second downturn that began in the same decade. We had a downturn in 2000 and another one that began in 2008 that's just played havoc. And, of course, there's been no let-up in the expectations on the part of resources and services we're expected to provide. We're bringing you today new national data about deployment in the clouds. We've been tracking the issue of movement of email to cloud services. Now we are extending that into ERP and some other areas. I think that for all the conversation in the campus and the corporate communities about moving to the cloud, we now can actually document how slow that movement has been. In fact, we have a new typology that we'll introduce a couple of slides down about where we are with different types of services towards the cloud. We continue to see transitions in the LMS market. No surprise there. Many of your campuses confront the sunset of your current LMS. Blackboard has announced it's going to retire its legacy WebCT and other kinds of systems, trying to migrate its clients up to Blackboard Learn 9X. There's about 700 Blackboard licensees, primarily but not exclusively higher ed clients, to confront that sunset by 2013. Many of you are doing bake-offs, and many of you are moving to other LMSs. So By way of context, Cynthia referenced the opening, the closing line of the 1990 report. Beginning in 1999 and 2000, we added a question to the survey asking our CIOs and senior campus officials, tell us the most single most important issue confronting your campus over the next 2 to 3 years. And this is a forced choice from a list of 10. In the first year of the survey, 60% of the respondents said it was either instructional integration or user support. I would argue those are the flip side of the same coin. But note the number, 60% settled on two items. As we go through the next several years, instructional integration remains the number one item, but it falls by half from about 40 to about 20%. A couple of other items pop up. And then notice it begins to flip in 2004 to 2008, 2009, in terms of network and data security. Still hovering only about a fifth, in some cases upwards of a third, indicating its network and data security. This is what it looked like for the last 2 years, fragmented. It suggests that, in fact, everything is either we have solved these problems or, in fact, everything is gnawing at us. Probably the latter as opposed to the former, particularly given some of the budget situations. What becomes interesting in terms of what's popped out, instructional integration is back towards the top. But the number one issue across all sectors was hiring. We've not seen this since the dot-com era in terms of the challenge of hiring or retaining IT staff. And that's particularly interesting given the downturn in the economy. I suspect the difference between now versus then is that 10 years ago, people were being poached. And now it's a matter of burnout. In the absence of budget resources, we've not been able to reward our people effectively. And we are asking them to do a lot more often for not much, with a lot more aggravation. In fact, we're seeing this as reflected in data you'll see in one of the later slides about employee malfeasance, security issues that are generated by people internally as opposed to somebody hacking on my network. The other interesting issue is notice the jump in mobility from last year to this, the percentage of survey respondents more up by a factor of three, indicating that mobility is my top issue. And you'll see how that plays out in the rest of the data. When we again sort of disaggregate these data by sector, we see some interesting differences either by the level of support for some of these items in terms of hiring, network and data security, mobility, but also the percentages in terms of what the top three are. And again, contrast these numbers against what we saw in the year 2000. So 60% of the respondents, two items accounted for 60%. In this instance, we've barely got 35% accounting for three items. One item in 2000, instructional integration, had more votes than the top three items among all campuses in 2011. I mentioned budget cuts a bit earlier. You can see that, in fact, they're down from the worst that occurred several years ago, but still high, and particularly for public sector institutions. We are experiencing the consequences of compounding. Albert Einstein, I understand, at one point said the most difficult math problem he could never solve was the one of compounding interest. We have compounding consequences. Because not only were our budgets cut, or many of your budgets cut, in 2008, they were cut off of that reduced base in 2009 and cut again in 2010, and from some of you, 2011. And on top of that, many of you experienced mid-year budget cuts that average anywhere from 2 to 5% as well. So with the reduction of resources on one hand, we've also had no let-up in demand for resources and services on the other. User support, the cost of going mobile, LMS support, network and data security, a whole variety of other issues. What are we doing about social networking, branding, other kinds of issues? Those fees don't go away. Those costs don't go away. And they've really created some very difficult choices for IT leaders on campuses across the country. When we disaggregate the data by budget line, not just central services, but, well, what's gone up and what's gone down within those budget lines, we get some very interesting patterns. So, in fact, for central IT services, the percentage of campuses reporting, again, was no change, just a little over a quarter. The numbers at the top, that plus 10, plus 8, represent the percentage of campuses reporting an increase from last year to this. So you can see the patterns, and the red represents not how deep the cut was, but just the percentage of campuses reporting a budget cut in that particular line. You can see, for example, that wireless networking went up almost a tenth. A lot of these are going up about a tenth in terms of rebuilding or extending a new definition of what's the infrastructure. Wireless is an entitlement. We know from Student Monitor, for example, that roughly most undergraduates own a cell phone and upwards of half own smartphones. And access to wireless for those devices as well as laptops and tablets, which now run about 15% according to our 2011 data, all part of the entitlement mentality that students and faculty and staff bring with them to campus, signal should be there for me, for whenever I need it, for whatever I need it to be. The other thing that we're seeing as a consequence of the budget cut is a lot of reorganization, actually, but this has been fairly consistent over a number of years. About a third of you reported that, in fact, we have reorganized academic or our computing organizations in the past year, and almost a third said we expect to do it again, and about half of you said, well, we've done it, and we expect to do it again as well. We're seeing a lot of churn in the organization of central IT services. Some of this can be a matter of, often as a matter of personnel as well as budget. Budget's been cut. Can we consolidate units under one leadership group, under one office? The other is a leadership issue as well, or a personnel issue as well. Somebody comes and somebody goes. A senior officer leaves, a new provost or president arrives, and it's his or her prerogative to reshuffle the deck chairs and move the organizational chart around as well. That accounts for a large part of this churn in the organization of IT units. We've been asking about IT security incidents for a number of years in terms of specific things. Somebody, did we lose a computer that created a problem with sensitive data? Network attack, something hacking on our network. Identity management numbers have been going up across sectors. The numbers are, depending on how you look at it, not way high, but it's about almost a third, and that's up from about a fifth a few years ago. And we've also seen an uptick in terms of campuses reporting social networking. Admittedly, you don't support social networking sites. None of you have necessarily endorsed these sites, but your students are obviously on them. They're using bandwidth to get there. And their behaviors on those sites are increasingly creating security issues for many of your institutions. The worst, of course, the sad incident that occurred in New Jersey last year that ultimately led to a student's suicide. And again, we begin to see how this disaggregates by sector, particularly in public universities, where the numbers are much higher than in other sectors. The other thing that we're seeing is employee misconduct, which is a stress indicator that somebody on our staff is doing something to create a security incident. They are acting out inappropriately and creating an IT security issue, and those numbers have been inching up a little bit as well as a stress indicator. For a number of years, we have asked you, tell us, do you have a strategic plan for IT security and disaster recovery? And consistently, since 2002, all the way forward, about 30% of you don't have one or the other. And so I've come to this audience in past years and said, 30% of you don't. Also saying, well, but we don't know, of those, the 60 or 70% of you who do, when was the last time you refreshed? So finally, asked if you've refreshed, so we've got some new data actually about the refresh this year to supplement and extend the data about do you have a plan. And you can see in terms of the last update, about 70% of those who have a plan have refreshed the IT security plan in the last year, bumping up a little higher in terms of within 2 years. Same thing for IT disaster recovery, about two-thirds have done that refresh in the last year, and about 80% over the last two years. Those numbers, in one sense, are pretty good. On the other hand, there's a large number of you that need to get this done if you haven't gotten it done, and some of you haven't gotten it done, at least according to our data, for a very long time. Participation strategy in terms of notification. Notification has sort of gone from 0 to 100% in the wake of the tragic events at Virginia Tech some years ago. Everybody's got one. Initially, they kind of cobbled it together, often, or went to third parties. Now, almost everyone, all campuses in our survey, have gone to a third-party provider to do these notification services. One of the key issues about notification, though, is at least I've come to this audience year in and year out and have said notification technology is the easy part of this issue. It's the planning for deployment. Do you have the scripts done? What percentage of your population is in that database? And what we have seen consistently is that, for the most part, campuses have used an opt-in. You must register for the service to receive the notification if, in fact, we activate an alert. And I've argued that, in fact, that's not a really good strategy. Because if only 20 or 30% of your campus population has opted in, obviously you don't have really good coverage. Technology is not the problem. It's the planning, it's the policy, it's the program, and the people issues. The good news that seems to emerge from this year's survey is we see the trend on opt-in going down. In other words, the default seems to be you are pre-registered and have to opt out. Lower numbers, clearly, at least I would argue, are better. You want people in the system. Let them take themselves out as opposed to have low numbers and have to go into the system for these kinds of things. In terms of how we're using these systems, first and foremost, obviously, for emergency notification. Second, weather alerts have become a big use. Campus is closed, stay away from the North Gate, whatever it might be. We seem to be struggling with other deployment. How can we get added value out of these systems once we have them? Very low levels in terms of recruitment, academic or student services, and also alumni notification. In some cases, you are doing those kinds of activities actually through your CRM, which often include kind of a contact communication notification. So it may be that those services may be located someplace else independent of what you're doing with your notification service. So if you happen to read Chronicle of Higher Education this morning, the Academe Today, or Inside Higher Ed, the lead story in our press release was about the clouds. I feel like when I saw our data for this, and I'm not much of a lyricist, let alone a singer, I felt like I should take the old Stephen Sondheim song, Send in the Clouds, and rewrite it as Send in the Clouds. Because what we have found in our survey data is that there's not much cloud activity in higher education, certainly not compared to corporate sectors, and especially on the really big issues that offer the potential for great savings, but, as you'll see from the data, offer some interesting risks. In fact, the data lend themselves to a topology of low, middle, and high clouds, sort of drawing off the widely used metaphor about low-hanging fruit. And the low-hanging cloud in this instance is clearly email. As you'll see in the next slide, the majority of campuses either have or are in the process of offloading student email to somebody else. But those middle and high clouds still remain out of reach. In terms of CRM and LMS, there's been some activity in those areas, but the really high clouds that offer the real potential for huge savings, but also offer risks for many institutions or perceived risks, are just not there in terms of ERP, HPC, and some other functions. So in terms of outsourced mail services, again, by sector, we are about well over two-thirds have migrated. That's up from about 58% last year. But notice the differential between offloading student and offloading faculty, a big difference. Many of us, and probably because our students have these accounts before they arrive, say, sure, let's take that someplace else and let somebody else do it. Not so with our faculty stuff. Whether it's a matter of security, command and control, e-discovery, whatever it is, we still want to hold on to that. Just a seventh of campuses are converting, and also related to that is the issue of about a seventh of campuses are converting to cloud-based apps. We still seem to want to host that on our devices as opposed to, in terms of office-like functions, as opposed to encouraging students to go to cloud-based apps. Who's leading in this? Consistently, when we presented this data at this forum each year, Google seems to have the lead in many market segments as the provider for those services. But talking about migration to the cloud, we see very little deployment in terms of what I would call the really big issues or the high cloud issues. So calendar, that's easy. That's a middle cloud activity. Many of you have moved calendar to the cloud. Some of you have moved LMS, and the providers have made that possible, increasingly offer cloud services, and you have found that to be useful because you don't want to do the hosting. You don't want to deal with the overhead of hosting and support in the back room for that. A little bit of CRM, but some of that also is that CRM, I suspect, is that CRM is new to many of your campuses as different units on campus are beginning to explore the value utility of CRM in recruitment, alumni, and other areas. And then there are the big three. ERP, HPC, and storage and business continuity. And there we see just a trace of activity. We break it out. You can see just how little activity there are in the big three. When we talk about learning management systems, many of the LMS providers have offered cloud services. Many of you have moved that way, have found that to work for you in terms of the continuity of service and also the cost benefit of doing so. I would argue that at least based on these data, on the metaphor of toe in the water, that the LMS sort of becomes the toe in the clouds. I view an LMS as effectively as an ERP function. What differentiates it from many of the others, it's not a suite. At least when I walked into the room this morning, none of the ERP providers owned an LMS that they were bringing to the campus market. None of the LMS providers owned an ERP company. That could change when we all walk out. There's been a little churn in the marketplace on some of these things. But for the moment, I would still argue that LMS, given the nature of the activity and the deployment, the fact large numbers of our folks are using it and it becomes mission critical, really has become an ERP kind of function in terms of both the what we do with it and the transactional data we can extract from it. And again, providers have moved in that area. On the other hand, when we look at ERP, I would say argue on both sides of the algorithm, of the equation, or the balancing iron, we see reasons why it hasn't happened. First and foremost, unlike the corporate sector, the ERP providers really have not really offered cloud services to their campus clients. We're beginning to see some hosting options, but it's only the beginning. And on the campus side, there clearly seems to be a lot of resistance. Trust is the coin of the realm. And I think that there's a high level of distrust, local culture, that says, I don't want to give this up. I don't want to let my data be someplace else. We have seen some issues where the clouds have reigned, if you will, experience with Amazon and some of the other cloud providers to corporate sectors in the last year that makes a lot of folks jittery. Where we may see more movement eventually, my guess, is in multi-campus systems, multi-campus community colleges, multi-campus state systems, where, in fact, the cloud offers advantages not just in terms of hosting and getting rid of the infrastructure, but also because these systems are going more and more towards concurrent enrollment. You're not enrolled in Acme College. You're enrolled in Acme College as part of the system, and you want to be able to take courses everywhere, and the cloud may provide some additional advantages towards that if we can get it done. In terms of HPC, again, the movement is quite slow. My guess is that a lot of the HPC activity that's in the cloud really is the choice of individual research groups as opposed to campus contracts and strategy. Some group somewhere on your campus, probably more likely public and private research universities and elsewhere, may do these contracts, may have these agreements, but the campus strategy is not yet there in terms of moving to HPC and research. That may change. Big announcement last week, as many of you know, from I2 about cloud computing resources pretty much targeted, not at ERP, but HPC kinds of stuff. So we may see these numbers jump, particularly for research universities that are part of the I2 constituency when I return to this podium next year. And all of you will give me that data, I hope, next year. Not enough of you laughed at that. We began tracking lecture capture, and we see lecture capture in terms of our survey respondents. Yes, this is an increasingly important part of our campus plan. It's almost becoming an entitlement at many institutions and for many departments. Students increasingly expect that if the continuum was I take notes in class, and then many institutions across the spectrum now have note-taking services that have been there for years, the next step up is, oh, yes, there will be a podcast. There will be a video archive of that class as well that will be available to me. Much of the traffic seems to be concentrated in large lower division courses, although it's often in some professional programs as well. Medical schools are doing this for part of their curricula, perhaps business schools, and not for the on-campus programs as well as the online programs. If we look at the actual numbers estimated by senior campus officials in terms of how much of this is going on, we still see it's pretty much in the single digits, but it's rising each year. And again, a lot of that also is concentrated in the lower division curricula. The future looks like it bodes well for e-books. Our numbers indicate about 15% of students own tablets, but for the most part at this point it seems to be supplemental as opposed to supplanting their other primary device, which is, of course, a notebook computer these days. But the survey respondent says yes very strongly, and those numbers go up. Digital content or e-book content will be an important curricular resource, and readers, while the numbers aren't quite as high, some kind of software shell that sits on some kind of tablet device from somebody, Amazon, Apple, Android, in some kind of environment or other, will be an increasingly important device as well. We added a new item to the survey this year. We want to know about Creative Commons. And this is really about producers versus users, because the question asks, do you encourage it, as mostly targeted towards, are you encouraging faculty to put stuff out there? But it also implies, are you encouraging faculty to draw on it? And we see what these numbers begin to look like. This is going to be, a very interesting issue to watch over this next several years, because it's part of the scrum in terms of the conversation about the cost of curricular resources for institutions and for students. And gets into some very interesting issues as well about IP, who owns it, even if you put it under Creative Commons. It gets into some very interesting issues about who supports it. Scott McNeely's comments some years ago, notwithstanding, the calculus hasn't changed that much in the 400 years since Newton sort of put it together. There are some really interesting and important issues for many of our faculty about who supports it in terms of instructional resources, updating. Calculus may not have changed, but a lot of other fields continue to change dramatically over time. The LMS market is in transition. We've seen what I would characterize as the continuing erosion of Blackboard's market share. Several years ago, about 2006, just after the WebCT merger, Blackboard's share was about 79%. It's now fallen to about 50% of our survey respondents. Again, a lot of this is because we've had two things. We've had new entrants to the marketplace. We saw a new wave of LMS entrants into this marketplace in the mid part of the decade with Angel, subsequently acquired by Blackboard, Moodle, Sakai, and D2L. And there's been a second wave in the last 2 to 3 years in Structure, Epsilon, possibly LoudCloud, two or three others that have yet to emerge. And in part, again, because of the retirement of Blackboard's legacy systems, we're seeing a lot of campuses that have to do something that may not have thought about doing something. That retirement provides a sense of urgency. That clock runs out within 2 years. Lots of campus committees, a lot of rich resources on the web for those of you that confront that. Last week at Inside Higher Ed, I posted as part of the Digital Tweed blog 10 questions to ask about your LMS transition. One of them is, how much can we learn from folks who have done this before? You may not need to reconstruct the feature and function matrix about all the LMSs that are out there, because there's probably some campus like you that's done that already, and it's on a website. And there may, and at least with public and private nonprofit institutions, a lot of these materials are readily available on the web. You can find peer institutions that have done this and go talk with them about that, their experience about why they either stayed or they went someplace else. Last year, we added a question to the survey about mobile apps. Are they important? The numbers were high last year and even higher this year in terms of what the survey respondents are saying, that mobile apps are an important part of our plan to enhance instructional resources. We have seen a dramatic change in the landscape of mobile apps from the providers. Blackboard effectively created this market. It was had the first mover advantage when it launched in 2009 with mobility. This market, which was once Blackboard's, is now everybody's, because it's not just LMS providers that are in this marketplace today, but it's also the ERP providers. And the cost of going mobile with the assistance of a third party has gone from significant fees to potentially free as a supplement or an extension of your existing relationship with an LMS or an ERP provider. We saw big gains in the percentage of campuses that went mobile last year to this. I was expecting 50%. In some cases, we saw a doubling, or even more. Look at community colleges, which is particularly striking given that they've had, like many sectors, really hard times in terms of budget resources for IT. These numbers are going up. It's part of the landscape. It's part of the entitlement mentality. It's, I can do this off campus. Why can't I do it on campus? Let's understand, mobile is not about the LMS. It's inclusive of it, but it really is about taking that portal from the screen of a computer or a notebook and putting it as a button on your smartphone. And again, given what we know about the trajectory of tablets and smartphone in this marketplace, you know, not surprising that we're seeing these kinds of resources and service, the campus commitment to these kinds of resources and services. Many of you have been going to the CIO website over the last couple of months asking your colleagues, what are you doing about print? Seemed to be an obvious opportunity for us to try to bring you a larger data set from campus computing in terms of your print policies for students. Do you charge? Do you not charge? Is it a limited fee? Again, all these slides are already posted for you on the campus computing website, campuscomputing.net, available for download. So you can see that the largest group, effectively you're saying pay for use charges, but it's all over the map in terms of different strategies that campuses are deploying about print. My guess is we're going to see some shift in this over time, again, given the revenue issues that confront campuses. Plagiarism is something we've also been tracking for a number of years. Numbers have seemed to have settled a little bit. That may be budget issues. That may be campus culture. We trust our students. The honor code works. Or, yeah, we'd like to do it, or we can't afford to add this to the bucket of resources. And finally, the last slide that I've historically presented to this audience year in and year out is, what are we doing? We're spending a lot of money on IT. What do we know about our efforts? Does IT make a difference? And consistently, we sort of see some ebb and flow in these numbers. But while a good number of campuses do have projects to assess the impact of IT on instruction and academic programs, many of you don't. It's wandering in the dark. And you'll see why this becomes important as I go to the next set of slides. So as I've done in the past, let me touch on a couple of key IT issues that come from and go beyond the data. I mentioned earlier the budget cuts. And this really is about infrastructure. Elsewhere, I've argued that we are building or effectively creating what I've characterized as Potemkin campuses, particularly in community colleges, but across the landscape. And what I mean by this is, if you know the story of the Potemkin villages, the Tsarina was coming to visit the Crimea. Try that. It's a good tongue twister. General Potemkin, at least the myth goes, created these villages with happy serfs so she would see that her new conquered territories, everybody was happy. No infrastructure, all facade. And if you look in terms of our response in the wake of budget cuts, in many cases we run the risk of being Potemkin campuses. We are offering courses. We're not providing the infrastructure to support students and faculty who teach those courses. Particularly in public institutions, we're not doing an effective job at user support, instructional development for faculty, access and support hours for students, other parts of resources for students. That's a continuing consequence of the budget cuts that we all confront. And it's compounding again. Einstein about compounding interest. It's not that it's gone 1 year and it comes back. It's gone, and more of it's gone, and more of it's gone, and more of it's gone. It's been a steady erosion. And again, referring to the data that I showed earlier, we see rising stress in IT units as reflected by malfeasance. Let me go on to the issue about instruction. Two views about the value of IT. We asked survey respondents this year, how important, what do you think your faculty feel about the role of technology? We've been doing this for a long time. 85% of the survey respondents told us that faculty view technology as a really critical resource for instruction. They agreed or strongly agreed. On the other hand, earlier this year with Inside Higher Ed, Campus Computing surveyed 950 college presidents across the country. It was really about what was going on in the wake of the economic downturn in campus strategies. But we included a question that asked presidents to rate the effectiveness of the technology investments at their campus. Libraries, on-campus instruction, online instruction, ERP, administrative systems, a variety of things. And that scale score was 1 to 7, not effective or very effective. Less than half rated the investment in IT for instruction as very effective. For those of you who live in private research universities, only one president in 12 assessed the value of IT for instruction at his or her institution as being very effective. Community colleges, presidents felt they got the most bang for the buck consistently across these things. And what should be daunting and concerning about this is that these are not 85-year-old college presidents. The median age was 57. These are folks, like many of us, who have come of age personally, professionally, professorially with this technology over the last several decades. They have learned, they have used, they are engaged in many ways. They are dependent, as are we. And yet here they say that as I look at the consistent and significant investment, which now runs about 5 to 8% of total campus spending, depending on campus sector, hardware, software, services, people, we're not really getting, it's not very effective. Now, you can interpret this two ways. Perhaps it comes, one way to look at this is the, and maybe the best way to look at this, I hope, is that this is the classic line from Cool Hand Luke. We have a failure to communicate. And I would argue that's probably the case. We in the IT community have done a terrible job on and off campus in communicating the value of the investment in IT. We see this in campuses. We see this in the public sector. When state legislatures know what they get when they pave the roads, they don't know what they get when they give us $1 million for IT, because we have to go back in 2 or 3 years. And we need to do a much better job about communicating the value of IT. Yes, it's great that students can now register online. That value is there. They're not snaked in lines around the campus quad. But on the instructional side, we still have a long way to go. If you read the New York Times, or you've heard about this recently, over the last 6 weeks, there have been two front page above the fold on Sunday stories in the New York Times about the deployment of technology in K-12 education, profiling both the software that's claimed to improve student learning and school districts that have made significant investments in one-to-one and other kinds of technologies to aid and enhance student outcomes. And what emerges from those stories is no significant difference. Story that we've heard for a number of years, no change in test scores or learning outcomes as measured by whatever metrics. You can argue with the metrics, you can't argue with the public conversation. And those of us in the campus community, if you read those stories, should be saying, there but for the grace of the digital gods, the New York Times has not yet found us, because they will. they will. And we have a lot of explaining to do, as Lucy used to say to Desi used to say to Lucy. Transitions in the LMS market. Some years ago, I characterized this market as a mature market with immature technologies, and I think that still holds. Mature in the sense that every campus has at least one. Our data indicate 90% standardized on one. They want to have one LMS stem to stern. The Blackboard course sites announcements, the Pearson class announcement last week, will be very interesting about how CIOs view this. You know, will you stand at the gate and say, not on my campus because we want one, or will you be willing to let campus individual faculty members sort of go off? More campuses, as you saw, are going to hosted service. We've got this time certain retirement, and we've got increased competition. That should be a good thing. It means more choice. But it also means that for those who migrate, there will be some transition costs. We've done a good job documenting how we got to the choice for all the campus reports about why we decided to stay or go for the campuses that have done a bake-off. What we typically have not done is do the financials after that's occurred. North Carolina has reported that Chapel Hill, that their decision to migrate from their current LMS provider to move to another one over the next couple of years, they expect to save about, I believe, $300,000 a year, about 40% of the total cost of operation of their LMS. Most of us have not done that. That would be a very helpful contribution to all of us if you stay or go, to start putting in some real good financials with these campus case studies about either how you got to that decision or what happened after you made that decision. The issue is, where are the clouds? Low level of deployment. And I guess I'm guessing again that in wake of last week's announcement, we're going to see some numbers rise. They may not be, they may be percentage dramatic, from 1 or 3% to 6 or 7 next year on HPC. The big issue is ERP. That's where, in theory, there ought to be huge cost savings. We are, you know, but there are also huge issues of trust and offering on the part of the providers. This is a market that's risk-averse. Most of us want to see somebody else sail off into the water of cloud-hosted ERP and come back and let us know if the world is flat or round. It's the exact pattern we saw, for example, when we saw a new LMS provider some years ago. Let somebody else be the early adopter, and then let them take the risk and come back and tell us if it works. So this is going to take time. And many of you have campus cultures that you will say, or your current leadership will say, over my dead body or my current job description, will we surrender this to the cloud or to our current provider? We want to keep it here, and we want to keep it tight, and we want to keep it in control. That may change over time if, in fact, some go and come back and say, yes, the world is round as opposed to flat. You can do it, and these are the benefits. I want to touch a moment about digital natives. Many of us attribute, or others attribute, to digital natives the fact that they have this overwhelming portfolio of technology skills. Just because they do the GGTT, game, Google, text, and tweet, we all know, and particularly faculty know, that that's not a portfolio of technology skills, whether they are 18 or they are 38. And you know, the good news is, increasingly, we've seen more and more campuses provide to entering students of whatever age, here's a self-assessment test. You need to be able to hit the ground running. One of the dramatic transitions that we have seen in the data from the Campus Computing Survey over the past two decades is the movement of the percentage of campuses early on. Many campuses required students to take technology courses. You need these skills when you graduate, not to navigate Acme College. And there was an inverse relationship in the early part of the 1990s. Campuses where the technology was pervasive and ubiquitous typically didn't have it. Campuses that didn't have much sort of required it as a way of signaling. At the time, many of you will recall, when campus parents and kids came to campus, traditional undergraduates, do you have computer labs? It's like asking, do you have food service? Yes, we have one, we have two. And how quickly they became ubiquitous even before ownership became ubiquitous. More and more campuses, but still not enough, are providing students with tools to do self-assessment, a hierarchy, word processing, web search, other kinds of things. We need to help students understand that the GGTT portfolio is not a recipe for success. You need to have these skills on day one, and it's not about having these skills for the job market. It's about having these skills to succeed as a student in at your particular institution. I'd like to touch quickly on e-books. CIOs, as you saw from the data, remain very positive, very bullish about e-books. And at the same time, I would argue this year, as I did with this audience last year, we still don't have enough of a clear, compelling statement about the value of e-books to date. And one way I would point to that is the data that we get from Student Monitor, which does surveys of undergraduates as consumers. In their spring 2011 survey, student monitor posed a hypothetical question to undergraduates. Given the choice of the same price point, I believe it was about $70 or $80, the book you need for your widgets course, would you take a new book? Would you take a used book? Would you take a digital book? Would you take an online, a rental book? 20% of the respondents said, 19%, a fifth, said they wanted the used book. It tells you about the value of prior highlighting and annotation for many students. And it speaks to some of the issues of feature and functionality that will get there eventually. But I think the other thing that we need to understand is that our students today and for the foreseeable next decade, the vast majority of our native freshmen, 18-year-olds coming out of secondary school, as well as our part-timers at 28 or 38, and the MBAs in our online programs, and all points in between, still came of age on print. Yes, there are some pockets of digital curricula in middle schools and high schools across the country, but most of us still have habits about studying and learning that are often ingrained in print. It's moving, certainly, but it's still print. And good, bad, or otherwise, that's sort of what we compete against. So, you know, in that context, I would stand still with the statement I made a year ago in one of the digital tweet blogs. We are not there yet. The price points aren't there yet. For all the expectation that digital will reduce price, it still remains the net use price for most students is if they can buy a used book and sell it back. There are tremendous advantages and even better potential in terms of digital, and those tools are getting better and more powerful in terms of links, annotation, but many students are still uncomfortable with them. Sometimes they're a bit cumbersome depending on the interface, other kinds of issues. This one's going to take a while before we move to an entirely digital curriculum at large deployment. A few more slides of shameless self-promotion. Just for those of you involved in online learning, I would point your attention to the Managing Online Ed Survey that we do with WCET, National Survey of Senior Campus Officers, looking at issues about the managing process for online ed. Who's in charge? Are you profitable? What's the enabling infrastructure? That survey is about to launch. We'd welcome your participation. We've been doing it now. This will be its third year. Also, I alluded to the Inside Higher Ed surveys. We've been started with presidents, went to financial officers, and then admissions officers. These are not about technology, but some of the data that comes back to this is about planning for technology and infrastructure, all available at Inside Higher Ed. And again, I remind you, this entire presentation is available as we speak at Campus Computing, at which point we have a couple minutes for questions. So let's do that. Thank you very much. So if you would please stand, deliver, tell me who you are so I can make an inappropriate inference about your question. Sir, I'm really annoyed you're taking pictures given it's available on the website. Thank you. All right. Somebody will tweet on that and say, Casey's testy this morning. They did that a couple of years ago. How many of you are tweeting? How many of you have said things like, that you concern me or my mother wouldn't like? Thank you. All right. Questions, please. All right. Who are you and your question? Jim Krause from SAP. You are an ERP provider?
We're evolving.
Okay. We're all evolving. Please.
Actually, part of my question is that evolution. I was interested. There's no mention of the use of analytics, especially as those analytics can help improve operational efficiency.
Yeah, actually, so the question was there's no reference to use of analytics. Many of you know that we complement and supplement some of your participation in the EDUCAUSE Core Data Survey. We try not to duplicate what Core Data does. So for that matter, in that context, we don't ask a lot of detailed budget information. We don't ask a lot of detailed information about who your ERP providers are. And I believe that there's been a growing, with the revision of Core Data, there's been some questions about analytics as well that we try not to duplicate. Okay? Other questions? That's it. I'm going to get off light. Going once. Please. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear your first name.
Regina.
Regina.
Koch.
Koch.
University of Pennsylvania.
Please.
I can see that there's an
Yeah. So the question was that the survey data point to an increase in mobile computing. Is that student activity? Is that faculty? Actually, what we measure is not the activity. It's the deployment of an enabling infrastructure or an environment. Have you activated mobile for your campus? And again, the analogy I would use is that, you know, if I have not been to Philadelphia in 5 years, now you used to come with a guidebook, I could land in the airport, download an app, and it would help me navigate the city. You know, is there an app for Acme College that would help me navigate the campus? Because those mobile environments really are portals on smartphones. It's the migration of bookmarks on a browser to buttons on smartphones. And we can see that there's been a big jump in the percentage of campuses that have activated for their institutions. Other questions? Please. Tracy Ledger Hornby. Thank you. We want to make sure you get your Warhol unit, and you are the Dean of Libraries at Worcester Polytech. Thank you. Yeah. So the question is that libraries, like the rest of us with large deployments of complex technology, ERP and other systems, too have been having pressures because of price increases against budget cuts. And what's been the response on the part of the providers? I like that term instead of vendors. It sounds softer for the providers in the room. How many of you are providers? We love our providers. We just don't like some of your behaviors sometimes. It's like our children. What's been the response of the providers? It's tough. I mean, my conversations with the providers, many of you sign contracts that are 2 or 3 years that bake in an escalator, and then when the contract's up, there may be a big jump. I think that the fact, at least on the LMS side, where there is competition and there's mobility, there seems to be less churn in ERP. Campuses stay with their ERPs, and there's huge values to incumbency in terms of protecting that. I think that stems some of that. I think the other thing that happens is that there's a lot of discounting going on that's under the table, either in terms of price discounting or added resources and services. We will throw something else on the truck to make this work. Sometimes it's hard to do that with state contracts that are under sunshine laws, but I'm hearing lots of that. One of the interesting things, and libraries are a good example of this, because when Elsevier bought up a lot of academic journals a decade ago, there were huge price increases that accrued to libraries for the subscriptions on that. I think a lot of the concern that many IT leaders have, given some of the mergers and acquisitions that are going on in the industry, how will that be paid back? In some instances, it's been not a problem. I mean, essentially, there have not been the kind of huge bump and the outcry that accompanied the Elsevier behavior. And there's a lot of this that's happened over the last year or two, and more of it that potentially could happen. So that one's going to play out. But I think, at least in the LMS arena, because there have been new entrants, because there's been a lot of competition, and because there's been a willingness of campuses to migrate because of new providers, new technology, that may help to stem some of, at least not the public posting of prices, but at least the private negotiation of contracts. I believe we've got time for one more question. We have to vacate for the next group. Please. Ina Haynes, Director of IT at Teachers College at Columbia. So the question was, could you clarify the definition of cloud in this instance? Is it going to somebody else's cloud or running its own cloud? We asked we asked the lowest and the most simple question. Are you on somebody's cloud, your own or that provided by a third party? Have you migrated this application or this service to the cloud? So we didn't differentiate. We thought the real issue, that's part of the implementation issue, cup to lip. The real issue is that we saw as the first quiz issue is, have you migrated? The nuance is if you've migrated where you go, but you can see certainly with what I would characterize as the high cloud functions, there's so little activity, that may not make a difference. A year or two from now, when those numbers go up, I think that's going to be an important part of the backstory. And that will be incumbent not so much on me, but many of you, to share those stories with your colleagues. We have migrated to the cloud for this function. This is how we did it. This was the rationale. This was the case study. These were the risks. These were the expected benefits. This is what we have experienced having done that. And I really would encourage all of you to try to get those stories out. It's not a dissertation. It can be a five-page case study. And please include the financials, because so much of our conversation about the financial benefits of some of these things really is epiphany as opposed to evidence. And here and elsewhere, we desperately need evidence. Thank you very much, folks.